Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com. On today's episode, I talk to Blake Mobley about the business of recruiting. We talk about the process of matching up people with jobs. We talk about how Blake's recruiting company interviews job seekers. We talk about the metrics by which recruiting companies are judged to be successful. We talk about strategies for determining if people will be a good fit for a job. We talk about people's professional motivations. We talk about personality tests. We talk about some connections between recruiting and Blake's work in the intelligence community, and more. Blake is the co-founder and managing director of a recruiting company called Keeper Recruiting. That's Keeper, K-E-E-P-E-R. Keeper Recruiting specializes in the biotech industry. Blake has served as the chief data officer at Waste Fuel Global, and before that was the chief information officer at Biosplice Therapeutics. Blake also served as a counterintelligence officer at the CIA, supporting clandestine operations and senior U.S. policymakers, including two presidents and their cabinets, with tours in the Middle East and Langley, Virginia. He's the author of the book Terrorism and Counterintelligence, and another book called Evading Secret Police, Counterintelligence Vulnerabilities in Authoritarian States, as well as other books and articles on political instability. Okay, here's the talk with Blake Mobley. Hey, Blake, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, thank you.
So maybe we could start with, maybe you could give an overview of what the recruiting business generally entails, and then what specifically your recruiting efforts focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. So typically it entails helping companies find people to fill open positions. So a job position opens for a need within the company, and then companies will either do that themselves. They'll either go looking for ideal clients, and when that's difficult, they'll tend to reach out to recruiters to usher the process from the search to evaluation and then through interviews. And then they'll generally take over at the end and make those final decisions for themselves. I work with a company called Keeper Recruiting, and we specifically partner with biotech companies on specialty roles. And we have a slightly different approach. We're interesting in a few ways. And my role specifically there is focusing on culture assessment, so corporate culture of the client, the company, and also in vetting candidates.
When you say specialty roles, what does that entail?
So within a biotech company, it's like a UN of job descriptions. You have everything from lawyers to scientists to business people, all walks of life and from very different backgrounds. We have so far focused on business development, alliance management, project management, some HR roles. A lot of the roles we focus on are very people-focused and sort of emotional intelligence, roles that require emotional intelligence. And that's where we focused our, you know, most of our vetting around those kinds of issues. So those come up for us most often. But, you know, within a biotech company, you're going to have regulatory, you're going to have clinical operations. So there's lots of different things happening there. And we kind of focus on that one little patch.
How did you get into recruiting, and how did you specifically get into the biotech area?
Yeah, so I came at it in a kind of a funny way. I was a counterintelligence officer at the CIA for the first part of my career, and I spent a lot of time thinking about people's psychology and what motivates them. Obviously, in that context, and supporting operations and ops officers who are looking for people to recruit, we would look at the kinds of psychology that is appropriate for a person who could take on that kind of risk, that kind of mental burden. But it got me really interested in how people think and what motivates them. And that's really at the core of counterintelligence, is understanding how people think and what motivates them. So in addition to that, I spent a lot of time looking at culture and organizations. And as you can imagine, we'd spend a lot of time specifically with clandestine organizations. So whether they're terrorist groups or rebel movements or drug trafficking groups or what we'd call foreign intelligence entities, intelligence organizations of a nation state. And they have really, really interesting internal cultures. And some of the pathologies they encounter as a clandestine organization are really different than other bureaucracies. So I also became very interested in how bureaucracies manage their internal cultures. Sometimes they have pressures to accelerate in a direction that is actually very bad for their culture. So we would pay attention to those kinds of things. And then when I left the government. I joined a think tank and eventually made my way into the biotech industry. And I spent about 8 years there as a chief information officer and as sort of a people officer at the company I was at. And in that capacity, got involved in recruiting and an analysis of team dynamics. And that generally got me very interested in, you know, moving away from thinking about the psychology of somebody with this enormous burden of espionage on their shoulders into how about normal people who have different kinds of pressures and burdens, but fit into their teams. Maybe they have a good day, they have a bad day here and there. How does that affect team dynamics? And how do you select people that are a right fit for everyone else who's on their team and for their manager? So that's kind of the full circle of coming into this space of recruiting.
I imagine the work in the CIA and Intel must have really shaped your philosophy around recruiting and matching people to specific jobs. And maybe you'd like to share some of the things that you think are unique about the way you approach recruiting and matching job seekers.
Absolutely. The one thing that really stands out when you're talking about getting to know a person and what motivates them is that it takes a pretty unique access point that person's willing to speak about what they care about. So getting to what we call their core motivators. For most people, there are just a handful of core motivators, things that really drive most of their decision making. And so a big part of the process is having their trust to have a conversation that they know is going to be open and that they have control over, and that you get closer and closer to what is a core motivator for the person. And in some cases, people will have a really strong sense of what those are. But on the other hand, I think very often people are introspective, but maybe when they have that kind of conversation with, you know, someone who's essentially a stranger who's just trying to be helpful to get there to that answer, they can be much more open about the conclusions and see some of these motivators more starkly in relief. And that allows them to think a little bit more deeply about what they actually do care about. So a really important part of our process, which is reflected in kind of the way the Central Intelligence Agency would approach a relationship like that, is really trying to understand a person, not judging them, not having any biases up front, but being really open about what do they care about. And a big part of that is long-term relationships. So it's much easier to have an open open conversation with someone if that relationship is strong and they trust you, that you're not going to use that information in some negative way. So we spend a lot of time thinking about how to make people comfortable and making sure that they're comfortable with the conclusions that we're coming to. So when we finish a vetting assessment, we always read it back to the person and say, does this sound about right? And this is what we're going to put in a profile. And does that sound good to you? Is there something that we could change or alter about this that would make it more accurate? That is a really important starting point for us. And the way that we're a little bit different, I think, than some of the other recruiting companies is that we're really focused on a long-term relationship. So if we're working with a candidate, we will always come back to them and make sure that they are being aligned with a company that they truly would have a good fit with. And if there's nothing immediately available, we are always coming back to those people for insight and to help them later on. So that's a big, really big piece for us.
When you talked about core motivators, can you give an example of some of those? Is that things like motivated chiefly by money, things like that?
Yeah, it can be. So money is usually a proxy for some other deeper interest. So, one example of a motivator might be belonging, someone whose interest is in fitting into groups and being accepted by groups. Money can be a way to get that for some people. Usually those are people that are very, empathetic and they are outwardly focused. So you might find them making decisions where they privilege in-group affiliation with things that you might expect they would care more about, so in some cases money. So they might turn down money to have an in-group affiliation. And when you're talking with that person and you're asking questions about choices they're making, you'll see that decision point continuously come up. So they keep biasing themselves towards a belonging. And another could be something like achievement or impact. So they might orient their entire existence towards making a big impact. And that's going to come everywhere from the job they take to the person they marry to how they raise their kids. It's all going to kind of flow back through this impact funnel. And sometimes it's really hard to see that if you're in the driver's seat of that core motivator. And when you step back, it can be a little bit easier to identify. But those are the sort of things that end up being core motivators.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I mean, I've worked with people that talked as if, you know, the idea that the people they worked with or the company as a whole was a family to them, that was very important to them. And that was always kind of alien to me. I'm like, I don't expect a company to be my family. So I think that's kind of an example of like, for some people, that is the belonging aspect and feeling connected is a big driver for them. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's a good example of where somebody who declares that they're interested in this family or tribal aspect of a company culture, you could look at that and feel very differently and think, well, maybe they're being strategic or they're misrepresenting their true interests to achieve some other objective. And if you appreciate that some people really care about that more than anything else, then it's easier to have a little bit more empathy and say, actually, maybe that really is the most important thing. And then you can trade off some things for that person. If they care a little bit less about some other aspect, then, you know, having a meeting with them about their career advancement is going to come in the form of recognizing what a good corporate citizen they've been and giving them even more control over their aspects of belonging. And that can be one of the things that would make them the happiest, even beyond things like compensation and other kinds of recognition.
Yeah, when you talked about being comfortable, having a long-term relationship with job seekers and getting their real motivations out of them, it reminded me of my small experience with recruiters where I had to remind myself that these people were there to help me. So it was to my benefit to be completely honest with them in a way that I wouldn't be with, you know, a job, the actual job I was applying to, you know, which
that's right.
didn't come naturally, but I had to tell myself like, well, these people want to find me a job. They're helping me. They're on my side. So I'd imagine, is that something you have to remind people? Do some people not have that understanding at first?
I suppose some do. I think it's, like you said, the dynamics of it are the recruiter benefits when the person finds a job, and really the recruiter benefits when that person finds a job that is a long-term and good fit for the candidate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we haven't had to reinforce that too much, but it's a really important point that where the recruiter interacts with the candidate is, you know, protected by confidentiality and that the sense of almost a diplomat, you're an emissary between these two entities, and you want there to be a good solution. And in our perspective, the best emissary is one who deeply understands both sides' positions and avoids matching people with companies that may superficially seem like it could work because the job description lines up, but you suspect deep down that, let's say, this person's drive or ambition isn't going to fit with this company's focus on things that are more communal. So you have to have that trust on both sides to make a good match. And the hiring managers we work with are really savvy. I mean, we are really careful to work with companies that have great corporate cultures. We only want to work with companies that care a lot about taking care of people and making sure they fit nicely into this broader culture they've established. And there are a number of biotech companies in San Diego that are really excel in this way. So those hiring managers, because they're within a company that a priori appreciates the importance of that kind of dialogue, they're usually pretty tuned in to these features too. So they'll pick up on the fitness of a candidate. And it's really hand in glove with making sure everybody sees it from all angles, and then we can all make a pretty good decision about whether the fit is a good one or not.
Do you find that sometimes people who are looking for jobs, who say that they're looking for specific jobs or say that they have specific motivators, and you believe that they don't actually know what they want, and in your opinion, their work history or their past experience shows that they would be better suited in something else? Does that happen?
It does. Yeah. So most people have a good sense of what they are good at, what they're competent at. So they've done it before. They know they can accomplish a certain set of tasks. And they might be happy for a time in that track, in that career track. For example, there are many people who end up in business development who love the complexity and adventure of the business side of biotech, who start off as PhDs and bench scientists, and they go through this process where they decide they really don't want to do the bench science because they're really removed from people. Their impact is a bit blunted from the bench, and they find it much more exciting to be involved in the pointy end of the spear of the scientific process in biotech, which is where that's expressed through deals being made and clinical trials being run and products making it to market. So you do see people evolving as they move through their career. And absolutely, there are people who become very good at something but are not particularly happy doing it. And it's a fascinating thing. It's a tricky transition to make once you're at a certain point in your career to say, I think I'm going to start over and try something very different. Some very courageous people do that. But it's usually easiest to just continue doing what you're good at and what you can make money doing. But in those interviews, absolutely, we'll occasionally see that misfit, and we'll think, oh, I wonder if this person probably is good at this, but they're struggling. Could they be good in a different industry? Could they try on a different approach to their career? Almost certainly. And there are companies that help people that specialize in these big transitional movements. Sometimes that's the right path for those people.
What is the main metric for success? Is it a job seeker that you get a job and they remain at the job for X amount of time? Is that the main metric for success?
You know, that is how it is currently done. So if you ask most recruiting companies what their success metric is by their contract, it's 90 days in the position. That's where the company won't be able to claw back the fee. But most recruiters will obviously want someone to really fit and work there for the long run. So fitness in the long run, and for biotech, you know, some of these turnovers are, it's a volatile industry. There's a lot of turnover. So 2 or 3 years in a place is very normal. So if you get that level of success, I think companies recruiters are happy with that. The companies are generally, you know, they satisfied with that result. For us, we're taking a little different approach, and we think, you know, why the name of the company is Keeper. We want people to really fit in and to survive and thrive in the long run in these companies. So we take the approach of keeping contact with people, making sure they're actually very happy working with the candidate too and the client as well, to make sure those processes can be can continue and they can thrive there.
So are there incentives given for longer term placements? Like, are there some situations where a company would give the recruiting company a bonus or some other thing if the employees stay longer? Does that happen?
That's a really interesting idea. I haven't seen that, but it'd be an interesting idea. I think some of the challenges with that are, I think that's actually very interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, but you can imagine structuring that in a way, particularly with more senior people. I can imagine that being a way to think about it.
I guess the main incentive or the main pressure on a recruiting company is just that if you're not placing good people who don't stay much, the company would move on to another recruiting company. Maybe, I guess, is my understanding that would be the main pressure.
Yeah. So there's so many recruiting companies that if somebody does really poorly, and it's on the company in some way, the client side, that they've didn't, you know, predict that this was going to be the right job description, or they had to change it, then blame is sort of diffused in a way. It's like, well, we all didn't find the right person. Mm-hmm. And some recruiting companies will distinguish themselves and say, well, look, no matter what happens, if this person isn't the right fit, we'll find you another one free of charge. So that's another common practice too, but very easy to move on to another recruiting approach or a company if something's just not working. Yeah, it's very easy. There are very few locked in contracts where it's a retained approach. That does happen, but for the most part, these are just sort of open-ended contracts, and whoever's going to be the best recruiter is going to win at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine word must get around about, you know, the better recruiting companies and such. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a very small group here, especially in a city like within biotech, but particularly within these cities where biotech thrives, like San Diego, San Francisco, Boston, very small communities. Yeah, word will get around for the good and the bad.
So when it comes to finding out about the personalities and the motivators of the job seekers, what kind of information gathering strategies do you use? How much of it is interviewing, and how much of it is maybe test taking, things like that?
Yeah, so mostly behavioral interviewing. So we usually do about 30 to 45 minute conversations, and that's about enough time to get through the CV and look for patterns. So, you know, one thing that we do really quickly is get people off script, the script that people have. It's not a negative thing. It's just something people do in these contexts. As soon as they're dropped into a situation they've been before, they've got a script. So as soon as we can get them off the script and just talking more kind of openly and freely without something in mind, that usually is really helpful. And then looking for patterns in descriptions and decision-making. Sometimes people will just use the same word over and over and just make a note. Can we come back to that word? So usually by the end of the interview, we'll come back and identify some of those keywords and the patterns and speech that have come up, and then walk through whether that's the right motivator for them, whether that resonates with them. We also do a lot on work competencies. So we'll spend a big part of the interview talking about the person's performance, their work strengths and weaknesses, and the habits that they have at work as they perceive them. So we'll talk about work style. And all these things kind of meld together and reinforce one another. But that's really the main approach for us, is that behavioral interview.
And when you say behavioral interview, what does the behavioral mean in that context?
So we would ask a question about, you know, why they would make a decision to move from one company to the next. What was behind that move? So we might say, it seems like, you know, you stayed here a little shorter than the other places you've been. Was this not the right fit for you? Mm-hmm. What was going through your mind in that situation? And then if we have enough of an anchor around a core motivator, we might ask a question that induces a response around that issue. So if a person's really focused on making a big impact, we might ask, how much of a factor was your inability or your distance from making an impact a feature of this decision you made, and get them to talk through that. There's a tricky bit here, which is the kind of cognitive bias of confirmation bias, where if you start asking questions around one issue, you might get them thinking and talking more about it. And so we have to be careful of that too, not to wind too tightly a circle around just one way of thinking. So we'll usually ask a few questions to the contrary to get them talking about things that have nothing to do with impact, and see if they bring it back to the main theme there.
So do you use any personality tests, things like that? What are your opinions on the value of those?
Yeah, I'm not against personality tests. We don't do that. I think anything that increases self-awareness is almost always a good thing, as long as it's accurate and helpful. You know, if it leads a person down the wrong path, that's obviously not good. But for people who are interested in what their, you know, Myers-Briggs, for example, would be, it's not a bad thing. It can increase that sense of introspection and the ability to be introspective about what matters to them. I don't think it's terribly useful in vetting, because it's a little vague. So for example, if I say, this is a person who cares about XYZ and their Myers-Briggs type is this, it's hard to know how that interacts with the workspace. Mm-hmm. It's conditional almost certainly on so many different factors. The aspects of social psychology come into play, that is the situation having a bigger impact than a personality on how behavior exhibits itself. So I think it's interesting as background, but not something that we would necessarily use to include in a profile.
I was reading an interesting critique of the Myers-Briggs test, and I think other personality tests in this hiring with your head book, and talked about how it was more like it was telling you what you wanted to be like and not necessarily, you know, what you actually were, what your strengths were. And they gave an anecdote of someone saying that they were, you know, a natural leader according to personality tests, but then didn't have any real world examples of doing that. You know, so I thought that was an interesting point of how those tests can go awry.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's true. Any test where you're reflecting on your performance and your habits, you may even have in mind a single example, maybe where you currently are working and you think, well, what would I do? But that's obviously a vector of the culture where you're working and how it's been pushing you in a certain direction. I mean, is that your true self? So really hard to know how to characterize those. Maybe if you had a Myers-Briggs that worked over time and was very standardized in a way, you could look at your Myers-Briggs over a year period and see like how are things changing in your answers. But I think you always come back to that challenge of maybe it's what you wanted to say. Maybe you don't actually have a great view of your own leadership skills. So kind of interesting way about behavioral interviewing is that you can sometimes ask questions that are subtle and it's very hard to fake the answer to. So you actually don't know that it's a question about leadership, but that is at the core something that question is related to. So that usually those are a little bit stronger for framing out, let's say, someone's management capacity or their interest in being a good manager.
Mm. Are you able to give an example of a question like that that's on the more subtle and direct side?
Yeah. So one thing that we do is we pay attention to something we're calling a pervasive signal, which is an example of a core motivator or an interest that occurs outside of the work context. So let's say you are working with a very senior person who was also a very good athlete in college, and you start talking to them about how they became an athlete, what was important about and why they picked the sport. You might find in that some reinforcement for why the brain works the way it does. So for somebody who was drawn to, let's say, chess and became a chess champion or was just very interested in it or still interested in it, you know, why chess? What is it about chess? Well, I like strategy. I like thinking a few moves ahead. I've always been good at it. If you believe that this is a person who one of the core motivators is taking the long view, a long-term planner, and that starts to fit in, okay, I see that part of their long-term planning motivator might be the joy of working out all the contingencies and steps in their mind and then seeing those play out. So you can kind of push the conversation in that way. So where they might declare that they love and are very good at long-term thinking, digging into the chess example or some athletic example or something unrelated to work, you can get a little closer to the mechanics there and a little bit harder to fake the pure job seeker response of, I'm just great at long-term planning and you'll have to trust me at it.
Mm, yeah. So it's digging into, what's driving the skill at long-term planning. It's the enjoyment of whatever sort. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So this idea of the pervasive signal is the thesis is that whether your core motivator is something that's been very helpful or potentially a hindrance at work, it's going to show up in every aspect of your life. It's going to show up in all your decision making and what you choose as hobbies and who the friends you choose. So you have to buy into that thesis if you want to be compelled by this way of thinking. I'm very convinced that's the way human psychology works. I'm not the only one. This is a very popular idea in psychology, but I think it's comes up against to some degree this notion of the very noisy psychology. That is, there's all noise around you. Your decisions you're making are based on things that are very hard to grasp. And I think that can be true for sure, that you would make a lot of decisions in the day that are seemingly random. But when it comes to decisions that matter, things that are really making an impact on your life, usually consolidate around these core motivators.
Right. Yeah, there's like a lot of chaos, but the important things we choose, there's a lot of factors driving those. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a harmony there that if you're listening to it, you can pick up on it.
How popular is it to use references to learn about a job seeker's qualifications and experience? I don't hear much about references that much anymore, and I'm curious if that's kind of fallen out of favor or something.
I'm not sure it's fallen out of favor. Certainly it's done. I think it's not done as well as it could be. I feel like when I've been involved in reference checks or seen them, it's usually to confirm some really basic things. For example, that the person held the job that they had. Usually the job seeker is the one who determines the references that are called. So they get to pick their phone a friend line. They put that out there. So you get to call people they've selected.
Right.
And so there, yeah, you'd think like, that's a kind of a strange feature of the reference check. Shouldn't it be, what is it about three? I'm not sure. It could just be logistically, it's easier to do that. So I've seen that done where you call the reference and just say, okay, did she work here from that time? How was it? You know, do you have any advice for her strengths and weaknesses? I think that's actually a great step. So even if you take that step, it definitely adds a lot to the process. Especially in a small community where a reference will be known to other people at your company. So they have a little bit of their reputation at stake. They can't just say whatever they want. Yeah. So there's skin in the game. It's a good way to say it. It's actually a very interesting way that terrorist groups and other clandestine groups tend to vet, because they don't have access to these big databases or reference checkers like the government here does. If you're getting a security clearance, there's an investigator who will talk to everyone you've ever met. They usually don't have that ability. So they have something that I like to call leverage vetting, where they use a person that would have a lot of their reputation at stake if this person turns out to be a bad member of the group. And that's a very sort of, not primitive, but it's a very effective and inexpensive way to do vetting in small communities. So there's a little bit of that in these smaller technical communities that you can take advantage of. One thing that I think is probably a slightly smarter way to use reference checks is to, once you have a working hypothesis about the person's motivators and how they'll fit in, those reference check conversations will include a few questions about allowing that reference to say something about where that person could fit in based on what you've seen. So I talked a lot with so-and-so about making an impact, and that seemed to be a pretty important feature of their work product and their happiness. How do you see that fitting into how you worked with them? They come back with, I can't really think of a time we've ever had a conversation about impact. It might make you question whether you were on the right track with that one. Or maybe they'll say, oh yes, that is so funny you bring that up. That was the number one thing that she was seeking here. And then you have a little bit more confidence that that was the right judgment. So the references can be used to double check and advance a hypothesis about a person's core motivator and whether they might fit in culturally with the company that they're targeting.
So it sounds like primarily you use the interview, the behavioral interview, and their CV, those are the main pieces of evidence you use to learn about people.
Absolutely. So the CV, the interview, where we talk about work competencies and this profile is built for them, and then the reference checks, and that's the first part. What happens then after that is the candidate will, if they're a good fit for the hiring manager at your client, they'll continue through the process, and then you'll continue to have conversations about them and their interactions with the various interviewers at the client. So you keep building out a set of how they're interacting with people, how they are perceived, where their culture fit might have been a little bit different than what you would have expected. So you think, okay, we'll have to adjust that on our next round of candidates. So it's a learning process all the way through. And they, fortunate enough to get the job and you stay in touch with them, you continue to learn about the company and the culture and how it's presented itself on their sub team that they're on and how they're doing with their manager. So the data collection can continue for that long-term relationship.
So it seems like there's a lot more, as you were saying, there's a lot of volatility or jumping from job to job these days.
Yeah.
It seems like in most industries, the days of the, stay at the same job for a long time is much less common. And I'm curious if you'd agree with that. And if so, how does that impact recruiting efforts and strategies?
Yeah, it's really common in biotech to move around. Companies' fortunes rise and fall by the month. So people move around, and it's not uncommon to interview someone who has been at, you know, four different places in 6 years, and they'd say, yeah, that was a layoff. And then why did you move? Oh, there's another layoff there. And it just happens. And particularly in biotech, and I imagine other technology sectors, it's not so unusual. So to move around is certainly not frowned upon. I think when it's an indicator of the person's inability to be happy at a place, let's say it's not a layoff, but they are just bouncing around, and then maybe they bounce around and they try something really different, and then they come back and try something else really different. And that might be more of an indicator that they haven't figured out what they are, what's going to make them happy. You know, maybe they were trained as an engineer and they don't love engineering, or they don't love the way the jobs they've taken in that space. So they're struggling for a transition, but they're still kind of pinballing around an engineering space. So those might be examples where you'd see that as a bit of a red flag. But just generally moving around is not seen as a negative.
Yeah, it seems like with all the, speaking of red flags and bad employees, basically, it seems like with the more people move around, the harder it becomes to tell what's going on with people's abilities and careers. Because, you know, I think we've all worked with people who seemed good on paper and you know, blended in, but then it became apparent, like, oh, probably the reason they're moving around a lot is because, you know, they're just not doing a good job or these kinds of things. So I'm curious, are there certain red flags that you look for that where there might be job seekers where you're just like, I'm not going to work with this person, those kinds of things?
You know, in terms of moving around, I mean, usually we'd have enough of a conversation with someone to get a handle of someone who's well-intentioned and it's maybe struggling to find what they're good at. That's okay. We can definitely work with people like that. And look, we've all been there. It's not anything to be ashamed of. And sometimes it's just a matter of getting out of a rut. I think the red flags for us are usually around non-responsive candidates. So you can imagine someone who just doesn't have the energy to engage in the process. They don't return the email to do the first interview, or you say, you know, we're going to have a behavioral interview and we're going to talk a lot about, you know, what really motivates you, what you really care about. This is important for the client we have that was interested in your CV, and we want to just explore that. And when you're in the process of the interview and the answers are like one word answers and they're not interested, and you can say, well, they're very, and that's okay too. Like, they're private. They're not used to extrapolating in a way that has something that doesn't exactly focus on what's in front of them. And you can't push those people. They're uncomfortable. They're kind of low openness for that interaction. Now, they might have a lot of openness with their friends, but they don't know me. So this, I just think of like if I can't get this far, it's going to be hard to strongly recommend them, because if they show up for an interview and they're just generally not open, I don't know how that's going to go. So if they're really good on paper,
you haven't learned enough about them too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of where it is. So non-responsiveness or being closed off in a way that's very hard to get them to talk about themselves is generally difficult for us to proceed. Yeah.
That kind of makes me think of, you know, getting off on a tangent, but it does make me think about the hardships that more introverted people have in the workplace. And it's something, you know, as someone who's struggled with anxiety and would consider myself a high introvert, you know, I sometimes think about that of how much you've got things stacked against you in that area for those kinds of reasons you're talking about. Like, even if you know, cause I've definitely been in job interviews where my anxiety kicked in and I just became kind of like shut down, you know? So I can imagine those, that becomes tough as a job seeker. Yeah,
it is. And I think that's why a good recruiter has the privilege of setting up a very trusting kind of space to have those first conversations. There's no risk. There's no one's judging. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, we haven't even maybe once or only twice or something, very small amount of our interviews are difficult like that. And even if they start that way, usually people loosen up in the course of a half hour, 45 minutes. So it's pretty rare. But if they're so introverted, they can't return an email to get a process on track, that's really tough.
Lack of motivation.
Yeah, lack of passion. But you're right. There's an interesting thing. So being introverted can definitely work against you if it produces the perception that you are not collaborative or not interested in being collaborative. So I would say for somebody who feels that they are struggling with that and believes that they're not getting a fair shake in an interview because of their introversion, then there are some strategies, absolutely, that they should engage in exercises to help them bring themselves out for those processes so they can show who they truly are. And of course, you know, at our company, we always work with people really carefully. So for anybody who's struggling with that, I would say a pitch for us is they can reach out and we can certainly help them tailor how they talk and how they are open about themselves. And we absolutely would want to help anybody that feels like they're struggling in that way. Because just as you said, it could be a terrible struggle when you get in that moment and you have a lot of anxiety. You can't just turn that off. It's not like, oh, I think I'll choose not to be anxious. It's overwhelming in some cases. So you might feel really stuck if you're in that case. And certainly it'd be nice if they could get the help that they need to break through that barrier and hopefully have, you know, some good interviews. And once they get comfortable with their colleagues, I think introverts, unless they're really, really painfully introverted, they do come out of their shell. They become more comfortable to people around them and they do really well.
Are there any lessons that come to mind from your CIA days that about finding and recruiting people that map over that you'd like to share?
Well, for sure. I mean, the one thing that you'll hear, now, I was not a case officer, an ops officer. I was a counterintelligence analyst. So I was supporting people like that. And I worked with some amazing people. And what they will tell you generally is that they have very, very close relationships with their assets and the people they're developing. It's not superficial. They really do have these tremendously trusting, deep relationships because they both have to trust that the other person is going to have their best interests in mind. So that for sure, for me, is something that maps over deep, trusting relationships where there's a lot of transparency and openness about objectives and obstacles and strengths and weaknesses is huge. And that's a really important part of Keeper, making sure we have really strong relationships on both the client and the candidate side. So that's important. And I mean, for me, just looking at core motivators, the extent to which those appear to drive so much of behavior is very eye-opening. And it's something that I find really fascinating. So I've certainly brought that idea in to thinking about why is a person making decision that they are. Some cases, it's not so much in biotech, but certainly in the government side, when I worked there, you'd see people making very strange decisions that could seem disastrous to an outsider. And if you had a chance to talk to that person, you might end up really appreciating, empathizing with why they were able to do that or why they did something. So that's important, that kind of empathy piece. Though again, not as starkly in relief in biotech, but approaching that conversation with an understanding of, like, let's say somebody can seem very arrogant. Well, just trying to understand, like, why are they showing me this arrogance? They don't know me. They've never met me. Mm-hmm. We're talking for the first time. Why am I getting this taste of arrogance? And what did they need to prove to me? So you're mm-hmm. kind of digging in. There's something there that is so powerful that for even a complete stranger, it's important to show this force. And yeah, so you can get like, okay, this is not their fault. There's something that has happened to them or something that they've adopted as a worldview that produces this barrier. And underneath that, there's something interesting. And so do we shut down conversations because we're annoyed by someone's arrogance? I think it's really easy to do. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have an exceptional tolerance mm-hmm. for arrogance and other things that might be a little strange just because, A, I'm so interested in what's underneath. And I'm also, as a person, my personality, I'm very interested in connecting with people. I love the connection. I'm very interested in belonging. I think mm-hmm. those are things that drivers for me. And so it gives me a huge amount of interest and tolerance for things that are a little off track because I just want to understand and be present for perhaps the emergence of a person who is grateful for the conversation at the end. So I stick with things, and I think that gives us some strengths at Keeper to continue with things that may seem a little off track at first.
Well, yeah, it must be. I mean, there must be some real map overs to therapy work, you know, where you're trying to actually get at the root of, you know, what they're about, and you have to avoid maybe some of their, you know, just kind of avoid or work around some of their more negative aspects, you know, to accomplish the goal, you know, which, so I think there's some mapping over there. Yeah.
I think there is. And it's strange though. So you have like, we're in therapy, you have all this time to evolve and be comfortable. And if we're just going to use a chess analogy here, this is like a blitz game where everybody's moving really fast. You can't really make any mistakes in 30 to 40 minutes. You have to keep things moving and try to introduce that kind of transparency early on. So yeah, it does have some map overs, but it certainly can't go as deep or produce anything that's really helpful beyond just saying, okay, I at least understand for the client I'm working for, this person is going to be a very good fit. I can see that they're very humble. They were very open with me right away. We're, you know, very interested in talking about what's motivating them. So, okay, I think this person is really going to fit with this hiring manager because they're just going to click. I know it. I know them both well enough at this point that that part's going to work. And then you have to talk about work competencies and all this other stuff, but at the very least, you know, they're going to click. And so, okay, I feel good at this point. I'm like, all right, I feel like at least we've got that box ticked and we can move on to like maybe some deeper things about maybe the person really cares about having a voice. Maybe that's like a key motivator for them. And so can we think about, are they going to be on a team where they're allowed to have a voice? Is this a team where there's lots and lots of people and it's hard to get a word in, but everybody cares about each other? Or is it a team where they would be really interested to have someone who's just a great communicator join the team and be very vocal? So then you think, oh, okay, this could be a really good fit because now I know they have a few factors now that are going to make them a good fit for this sub team that they're going to potentially join.
So considering the importance of in the recruiting process of getting to know people in a quick, short period of time, are there certain practical techniques you have for setting people at ease and getting them to open up more?
Yeah, it's certainly tough because you're going so fast. I think the idea that you're there to help them is certainly a good starting point. So they know that all the questions you're asking are designed to produce a profile that's going to be helpful for them to get to the next step. So that's usually kind of a trusting start. Where we're working with candidates that we've known in the past is even easier because then we know them so well, they really trust us to have their back and to describe them in a way that's authentic and accurate, but also positions them to be successful. And we wouldn't put forward a candidate they didn't think would have some degree of success. So all of that kind of creates kind of a trusting environment. So another thing that I think can be really interesting in thinking about making a person comfortable is quickly getting to, there are a few dichotomies that I think are, you just generally accrue to people, but particularly in these like job recruiting conversations. The first is whether they're structure tolerant or chaos tolerant. So some people really like structure. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have this chaos tolerance, maybe not appreciating chaos. Some people do. They'll actually go towards that. So understanding that off the bat helps not just with the flow of the conversation, but getting details of like, you know, why they are that way. So you can imagine some engineers are going to be typically more structure interested. And that can sometimes come down to a little bit of like control needs. So you get a little bit of control when you have structure. It's easier to process the environment. Mm-hmm. Another really important one is low energy versus high energy. This can sometimes get to that introversion challenge. If someone has a low energy state, it's not a deal breaker. It's just a different way that they're interacting. So if I bring a really high energy approach to the conversation, it's going to be very off-putting for someone who has like a lower energy state. So I try to just get a sense of like, are they a fast talker? How deep do they go? How quickly? And then you kind of moderate that. So that I think helps with comfort. There's two other things that are interesting that aren't necessarily designed to produce a comfortable environment that I think are really useful. One is whether a person is more empathy oriented, or I could say like interdependently oriented versus independent. So that's not to say that people who are independent have lower empathy, but they tend to, if you put people on the spectrum, by definition, the people on the independent side are going to typically be more comfortable with decisions that are useful for them, but might produce some challenges with interdependency. So As you can imagine, there are people who really difficult for them to take a decision where it's going to harm some people that are close to them, even if it's better for them and for the other people. So there's almost a paralysis around accounting for the empathy deficits that are occurring as a result of a decision. And some people make those decisions really, really fast. It's like, this is what's best. I'm so sorry. Tough love. Like, this is what we're doing right now. And the last one that I find really interesting for understanding people generally is where they fit. And I actually think this is the one that's closest related to happiness and probably job satisfaction would come into this, is whether they're more gratitude focused versus entitlement. And again, it's not to judge either side, but entitlement, it seems to me, tends to affiliate itself and accrue to behaviors and situations that ultimately become dissatisfying. Because if you're entitled to everything from people being kind to you or entitled to the way the traffic is flowing that morning, that produces this sort of more action-oriented, I kind of deserve more than what I'm getting right now. And on the gratitude end of the spectrum, you see the opposite, which is whatever I have in front of me is what I have in front of me. And I'm just going to be grateful for it. That can also lead to challenges, right? People who don't do a lot, they're more passive in the face of challenges because they'd say, well, I think I can be happy with this, even though it's a challenge. So understanding where people fit into that is interesting. But I have found, generally speaking, people who are more on the gratitude side are usually happier, and they tend to sort of fit in easier at jobs because whatever comes at them in those first couple months, they adapt to it. They think of it as part of the process. And if you're more entitlement focused, you might make more changes where you go. And maybe that's a good thing too, that you come in and make changes quickly, but you're generally not going to be as happy. So that's an interesting coin that has two sides to it. Mm-hmm.
Anything else you'd like to share? We've covered a lot, but is there anything else you'd want to share that sticks out to you that might be interesting behavior or psychology-wise?
I think we covered quite a bit of it. I mean, there's certainly, and I know you and I had talked about some of these cliched interview-type questions, and early on we were kind of joking about how it'd be sort of like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I always thought that was kind of funny too, and My only thought in having reflected on that a little bit more was that I think they can be really useful if they're situated in this broader framework we've been talking about, that can actually get you somewhere. So it's not necessarily a bad question, but in isolation, it can be misleading or neutral. So I always find that kind of interesting. Like, there's a push to standardize interview questions. I saw, you know, one example of where the intercoder reliability for the questions becomes high when you ask the same exact question to like hundreds of people you're interviewing. And I think if you're interviewing for a position where you have to decide, you know, you're hiring 100 people and you're interviewing 600, that might actually make a lot of sense. It's tougher though, I think, when you get into these more nuanced conversations and specialty positions where you may only interview two or three people, then the behavioral interview where there's a lot of nuance, I think that has to come out in that space because it's just so hard to standardize and ask these broad questions and get something really carefully extracted from that that's useful for you.
Thanks a lot, Blake. This has been great. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome.
That was Blake Mobley, who is the co-founder and managing director at Keeper Recruiting, which specializes in biotech recruiting. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.